Side 2, Valis, by Philip K. Dick, continuing on page 45. I had a lot of time to meditate during the intensive cardiac care unit, or ward, and I realized that years of self-abnegation and denial manifested itself in my destructive act. But what amazed me the most was the wisdom of my body, which knew not only to defend itself from my mind, but specifically how to defend itself. I realize now that Yeats's statement, "I am an immortal soul tied to the body of a dying animal," is diametrically opposite to the actual state of affairs vis-à-vis the human condition. The psych tech said, "We'll talk to you outside after we've made our decision." Fat said, "I miss my son." No one looked at him. "I thought Beth might hurt Christopher," Fat said. That was the only true statement he had made since entering the room. He had tried to kill himself, not so much because Beth had left him, but because, with her living elsewhere, he could not look after his little son. Presently he sat outside in the corridor, on a plastic and chrome couch, listening to a fat old woman tell how her husband had plotted to kill her by pumping poison gas under the door of her bedroom. Fat thought back over his life. He did not think about God, who he had seen. He did not say to himself, "I am one of the few human beings who has actually seen God." Instead, he thought back to Stephanie, who had made him the little clay pot which he called Oh-Ho, because it seemed like a Chinese pot to him. He wondered if Stephanie had become a heroin addict by now, or had been locked up in jail, as he was now locked up, or was dead, or married, or living in the snow in Washington like she had always talked about, the state of Washington, which she had never seen but dreamed about. Maybe all of those things, or none of them. Maybe she had been crippled in an auto accident. He wondered what Stephanie would say to him if she could see him now, locked up, his wife and child gone, the choke on his car not working, his mind fried. Were his mind not fried, he probably would have thought about how lucky he was to be alive, not in the philosophical sense of lucky, but in the statistical sense. Nobody survives 49 tabs of high-grade pure digitalis. As a general rule, twice the prescribed dose of digitalis will off you. Fat's prescribed dose had been fixed at QID, 4 a day. He had swallowed 12.25 times his prescribed daily dose and survived. The infinite mercies of God make no sense whatsoever in terms of practical considerations. In addition, he had downed all his Librium, 20 Quide and 60 Apretheline, plus half a bottle of wine. All that remained of his medication was a bottle of Miles Nervine. Fat was technically dead. Spiritually, he was dead, too. Either he had seen God too soon or he had seen him too late. In any case, it had done him no good at all in terms of survival. Encountering the living God had not helped to equip him for the tasks of ordinary endurance, which ordinary men, not so favored, handle. But it could also be pointed out, and Kevin had done so, that Fat had accomplished something else in addition to seeing God. Kevin had phoned him up one day in excitement, having in his possession another book by Mircea Eliade. "Listen," Kevin said, "you know what Eliade says about the dream time of the Australian bushman? He says that the anthropologists are wrong in assuming that the dream time is time in the past. Eliade says that it's another kind of time going on right now, which the bushmen break through and into, the age of the heroes and their deeds. Wait, I'll read you the part." An interval of silence. "Fuck," Kevin then said, "I can't find it. But the way they prepare for it is to undergo dreadful pain. It's their ritual of initiation. You were in a lot of pain when you had your experience. You had that impacted wisdom tooth, and you were..." On the phone, Kevin lowered his voice. He had been shouting. "You remember. Afraid about the authorities getting you." "I was nuts," Fat had answered. "They weren't after me." "But you thought they were. And you were so scared you fucking couldn't sleep at night, night after night. And you underwent sensory deprivation." "Well, I lay in bed unable to sleep." "You started seeing colors, floating colors." Kevin had begun to shout again in excitement. when his cynicism vanished, he became manic. That's described in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That's the trip across to the next world. You were mentally dying from stress and fear. That's how it's done, reaching into the next reality, the dream time. Right now, Fat sat on the plastic and chrome couch mentally dying. In fact, he was already mentally dead, and in the room he had left, the experts were deciding his fate, passing sentence and judgment on what remained of him. It is proper that technically qualified non-lunatics should sit in judgment on lunatics. How could things be otherwise? If they could just get across to the dream time, Kevin shouted. That's the only real time. All the real events happen in the dream time. The actions of the gods. Beside Fat, the huge old lady held up a plastic pan. For hours she had been trying to throw up the Thorazine they had forced on her. She believed, she rasped at Fat, that the Thorazine had poison in it, by which her husband, who had penetrated the top levels of the hospital staff under a variety of names, intended to finish killing her. "You found your way into the upper realm," Kevin declared. "Isn't that how you put it in your journal?" 48. Two realms there are, upper and lower. The upper, derived from Hyper-Universe 1, or Yang, Form 1 of Parmenides, is sentient and volitional. The lower realm, or Yin, Form 2 of Parmenides, is mechanical, driven by blind, efficient cause, deterministic and without intelligence, since it emanates from a dead source. In ancient times it was termed astral determinism. We are trapped, by and large, in the lower realm, but are, through the sacraments, by means of the plasmate, extricated. Until astral determinism is broken, we are not even aware of it, so occluded are we. The empire never ended. A small, pretty, dark-haired girl walked silently past Fat and the huge old woman, carrying her shoes. At breakfast time, she had tried to smash a window using her shoes, and then, having failed, knocked down a 6-foot-high black technician. Now the girl had about her the presence of absolute calm. "The empire never ended," Fat quoted to himself. That one sentence appeared over and over again in his exegesis. It had become his tagline. Originally, the sentence had been revealed to him in a great dream. In the dream, he again was a child, searching dusty used bookstores for rare old science fiction magazines, in particular Astoundings. In the dream, he had looked through countless tattered issues, stacks upon stacks, for the priceless serial entitled The Empire Never Ended. If he could find it and read it, he would know everything. That had been the burden of the dream. Prior to that, during the interval in which he had experienced the two-world superimposition, he had seen not only California, USA, of the year 1974, but also ancient Rome. He had discerned within the superimposition a gestalt shared by both space-time continua, their common element, a black iron prison. This is what the dream referred to as the Empire. He knew it because, upon seeing the black iron prison, he had recognized it. Everyone dwelt in it without realizing it. The black iron prison was their world. Who had built the prison, and why, he could not say. But he could discern one good thing. The prison lay under attack. An organization of Christians, not regular Christians, such as those who attended church every Sunday and prayed, but secret, early Christians, wearing light gray-colored robes, had started an assault on the prison, and with success. The secret early Christians were filled with joy. Fat, in his madness, understood the reason for their joy. This time the early, secret, gray-robed Christians would get the prison rather than the other way around. The deeds of the heroes in the sacred dream time, the only time, according to the Bushman, that was real. Once, in a cheap science fiction novel, Fat had come across a perfect description of the black iron prison, but set in the far future. So if you superimposed the past, ancient Rome, over the present, California in the 20th century, and superimposed the far future world of the android Cried Me a River over that, You got the Empire, the Black Iron Prison, as the supra or trans-temporal constant. Everyone who had ever lived was literally surrounded by the iron walls of the prison. They were all inside it, and none of them knew it, except for the gray-robed secret Christians. That made the early secret Christians supra or trans-temporal too, which is to say, present at all times, a situation which Fath could not fathom. How could they be early but in the present and the future? And if they existed in the present, why couldn't anyone see them? On the other hand, why couldn't anyone see the walls of the Black Iron Prison, which enclosed everyone, including himself, on all sides? Why did these antithetical forces emerge into palpability only when the past, present, and future somehow, for whatever reason, got superimposed? Maybe in the Bushman's dream time, no time existed. But if no time existed, how could the early secret Christians be scampering away in glee from the Black Iron Prison which they had just succeeded in blowing up? And how could they blow it up, back in Rome circa 70 CE, since no explosives existed in those days? And how, if no time passed in the dream time, could the prison come to an end? It reminded Fat of the peculiar statement in Parsifal. You see, my son, here time turns into space. During his religious experience in March of 1974, Fat had seen an augmentation of space, yards and yards of space, extending all the way to the stars. Space opened up around him as if a confining box had been removed. He had felt like a tomcat which had been carried inside a box on a car drive, and then they'd reached their destination, and he had been let out of the box, let free. And at night, in sleep, he had dreamed of a measureless void, yet a void which was alive. The void extended and drifted and seemed totally empty, and yet it possessed personality. The void expressed delight in seeing Fat, who in the dreams had no body. He, like the boundless void, merely drifted, very slowly. And he could, in addition, hear a faint humming, like music. Apparently the void communicated through this echo, this humming. You, of all people, the void communicated, out of everyone, it is you I love the most. The void had been waiting to be reunited with Horse Lover Fat, of all the humans who had ever existed. Like its extension into space, the love in the void lay boundless. It and its love floated forever. Fat had never been so happy in all his life. The psych tech walked up to him and said, "We are holding you for 14 days. "I can't go home?" Fat said. "No, we feel you need treatment. You're not ready to go home yet." "Read me my rights," Fat said, feeling numb and afraid. "We can hold you 14 days without a court hearing. After that, with court approval, we can, if we feel it's necessary, hold you another 90 days. Fat knew that if he said anything, anything at all, they would hold him the 90 days. So he said nothing. When you are crazy, you learn to keep quiet. Being crazy and getting caught at it out in the open turns out to be a way to wind up in jail. Fat now knew this. Besides having a county drunk tank, the county of Orange had a county lunatic tank. He was in it. He could stay in it for a long time. Meanwhile, back at home, Beth undoubtedly was taking everything she wanted from their house to the apartment she had rented. She had refused to tell him where the apartment was. She wouldn't even tell him the city. Actually, although Fat didn't know it at the time, due to his own folly, he had allowed payment on his house to lapse, as well as on his car. He had not paid the electric bill nor the phone bill. Beth, distraught over Fat's mental and physical state, could not be expected to take on the crushing problems Fat had created. So, when Fat got out of the hospital and returned home, he found a notice of foreclosure, his car gone, the refrigerator leaking water, and when he tried to phone for help, the phone was dreadfully silent. This had the effect of wiping out what little morale he had left, and he knew it was all his own fault. It was his karma. Right now, Fat did not know these things. All he knew was that he had been thrown in the lockup for a minimum of 2 weeks. Also, he had found out one other thing from the other patients. The County of Orange would bill him for his stay in the lockup. As a matter of fact, his total bill, including that portion covering his time in the cardiac intensive care ward, came to over $2,000. Fat had gone to the county hospital in the first place because he didn't have the money to be taken to a private hospital. So now he had learned something else about being crazy. Not only does it get you locked up, but it costs you a lot of money. They can bill you for being crazy, and if you don't pay or can't pay, they can sue you. And if a court judgment is issued against you and you fail to comply, they can lock you up again, as being in contempt of court. When you consider that Fat's original suicide attempt had emanated out of deep despair, the magic of his present situation, the glamour, somehow had departed. Beside him on the plastic and chrome couch, the huge old lady continued to throw up her medication in the plastic basin provided by the hospital for such matters. The psych tech had taken hold of Fat by the arm to lead him to the ward where he would be confined during the 2 weeks ahead. They called it the North Ward. Unprotestingly, Fat accompanied the psych tech out of the receiving ward, across the hall and into the North Ward, where once again the door got locked behind him. "Fuck," Fat said to himself. The psych tech escorted Fat to his room, which had two beds in it instead of six cots, and then took Fat to a small room to get a questionnaire filled out. "This'll only take a few minutes," the psych tech said. In the small room stood a girl, a Mexican girl, heavy-set, with rough, dark skin and huge eyes, dark and peaceful eyes, eyes like pools of fire. Fat stopped dead in his tracks as he saw the girl's flaming, peaceful, huge eyes. The girl held a magazine open on top of a TV set. She displayed a crude drawing printed on the page, a picture of the peaceful kingdom. The magazine, Fat realized, was the Watchtower. The girl, smiling at him, was a Jehovah's Witness. The girl said in a gentle and moderated voice, to Fat and not to the psych tech, "Our Lord God has prepared for us a place to live where there will be no pain and no fear. And see, the animals lie happily together, the lion and the lamb, as we shall be, all of us, friends who love one another, without suffering or death, forever and ever with our Lord Jehovah, who loves us and will never abandon us, whatever we do." "Debbie, please leave the lounge," the psych tech said. Still smiling at Fat, the girl pointed to a cow and a lamb in the crude drawing. "All beasts, all men, all living creatures, great and small, will bask in the warmth of Jehovah's love when the kingdom arrives. You think it will be a long time, but Christ Jesus is with us today." Then, closing up the magazine, the girl, still smiling but now silent, left the room. "Sorry about that," the psych tech said to Fat. "Gosh," Fat said, amazed. "Did she upset you?" "I'm sorry about that. She's not supposed to have that literature. Somebody must have smuggled it into her." Fat said, "I'll be okay." He realized it. It dazed him. "Let's get this information down," the psych tech said, seating himself with his clipboard and pen. "The date of your birth." "You fool," Fat thought. "You fucking fool. God is here in your goddamn mental hospital, and you don't know it. You see it, but you don't know it. You have been invaded, and you don't even know it." He felt joy. He remembered entry 9 from his exegesis. "He lived a long time ago, but he is still alive." "He is still alive," Fat thought. "After all that's happened, after the pills, after the slashed wrist, after the car exhaust, after being locked up, he is still alive." After a few days, the patient he liked best in the ward was Doug, a large, young, deteriorated hebephrenic who never put on street clothing but simply wore a hospital gown open at the back. The women in the ward washed, cut, and brushed Doug's hair because he lacked the skills to do those things himself. Doug did not take his situation seriously, except when they all got wakened up for breakfast. Every day, Doug greeted Fat with terror. "The TV lounge has devils in it," Doug always said every morning. I'm afraid to go in there. Can you feel it? I feel it even walking past it. When they all made out their lunch orders, Doug wrote, "Swill." "I'm ordering swill," he told Fat. Fat said, "I'm ordering dirt." In the central office, which had glass walls and a locked door, the staff watched the patients and made notations. In Fat's case, it got noted down that when the patients played cards, which took up half their time since no therapy existed, Fat never joined in. The other patients played poker and blackjack, while Fat set off by himself reading. "Why don't you play cards?" Penny, a psych tech, asked him. "Poker and blackjack are not card games, but money games," Fat said, lowering his book. "Since we're not allowed to have any money on us, there's no point in playing." "I think you should play cards," Penny said. Fat knew that he had been ordered to play cards, so he and Debbie played kids' cards games like fish. They played fish for hours. The staff watched from their glass office and noted down what they saw. One of the women had managed to retain possession of her Bible. For the 35 patients, it was the only Bible. Debbie was not allowed to look at it. However, at one turn in the corridor, they were locked out of their rooms during the day so that they could not lie down and sleep. The staff couldn't see what was happening. Fat sometimes turned their copy of the Bible, their communal copy, over to Debbie for a fast look at one of the Psalms. The staff knew what they were doing and detested them for it, but by the time a tech got out of the office and down the corridor, Debbie had strolled on. Mental inmates always move at one speed and one speed only, but some always move slowly and some always run. Debbie, being wide and solid, sailed along slowly, as did Doug. Fat, who always walked with Doug, matched his pace to his. Together they circled around and around the corridor, conversing. Conversations in mental hospitals resemble conversations in bus stations, because in a Greyhound bus station everyone is waiting, and in a mental hospital, especially a county lockup mental hospital, everyone is waiting. They wait to get out. Not much goes on in a mental ward, contrary to what mythic novels relate. Patients do not really overpower the staff, and the staff does not really murder the patients. Mostly people read or watch TV, or just sit smoking, or try to lie down on the couch and sleep, or drink coffee, or play cards, or walk, and three times a day trays of food are served. The passage of time is designated by the arrival of the food carts. At night, visitors show up and they always smile. Patients in a mental hospital can never figure out why people from the outside smile. To me, it remains a mystery to this day. Medication, which is always referred to as meds, gets doled out at irregular intervals from tiny paper cups. Everyone is given Thorazine plus something else. They do not tell you what you are getting, and they watch to make sure you swallow the pills. Sometimes the meds nurses fuck up and bring the same tray of medication around twice. The patients always point out that they just took their meds 10 minutes ago, and the nurses give them the meds again anyhow. The mistake is never discovered until the end of the day, and the staff refuses to talk about it to the patients, all of whom now have twice as much Thorazine in their systems as they are supposed to have. I have never met a mental patient, even the paranoid ones, who believed that double dosing was a tactic to over-sedate the ward deliberately. It is patently obvious that the nurses are dumb. The nurses have enough trouble figuring out which patient is which and finding each patient's little paper cup. This is because a ward population constantly changes. New people arrive, old people get discharged. The real danger in a mental ward is that someone spaced out on PCP, note, also known as angel dust, end of note, will be admitted by mistake. The policy of many mental hospitals is to refuse PCP users and force the armed police to process them. The armed police constantly try to force the PCP users onto the unarmed mental hospital patients and staff. Nobody wants to deal with a PCP user, for good reasons. The newspapers constantly relate how a PCP freak, locked up in a ward somewhere, bit off another person's nose or tore out his own eyes. Fat was spared this. He did not even know such horrors existed. This came about through the wise planning of OCMC, which made sure that no PCP head wound up in the North Ward. In point of fact, Fat owed his life to OCMC, as well as $2,000, although his mind remained too fried for him to appreciate this. When Beth read the itemized bill from OCMC, she could not believe the number of things they had done for her husband to keep him alive. The list ran to 5 pages. It even included oxygen. Fat did not know it, but the nurses at the intensive cardiac care ward believed that he would die. They monitored him constantly. Every now and then, in the intensive cardiac care ward, an emergency warning siren sounded. It meant someone had lost vital signs. Fat, lying in his bed attached as he was to the video screen, felt as if he had been placed next to a switching yard for railroad trains. Life support mechanisms constantly sounded their various noises. It is characteristic of the mentally ill to hate those who help them and love those who connive against them. Fat still loved Beth, and he detested OCMC. This showed he belonged in the North Ward. I have no doubt of it. Beth knew when she took Christopher and left for parts unknown that Fat would try suicide. He'd tried it in Canada. In fact, Beth planned to move back in as soon as Fat offed himself. She told him so later. Also, she told him that it had infuriated her that he'd failed to kill himself. When he asked her why that had infuriated her, Beth said, "You have once again shown your inability to do anything." The distinction between sanity and insanity is narrower than the razor's edge, sharper than a hound's tooth, more agile than a mule deer. It is more elusive than the merest phantom. Perhaps it does not even exist. Perhaps it is a phantom. Ironically, Fat hadn't been tossed into the lockup because he was crazy, although he was. The reason, technically, consisted of the danger to yourself law. Fat constituted a menace to his own well-being, a charge that could be brought against many people. At the time he lived in the North Ward, a number of psychological tests were administered to him. He passed them, but on the other hand, he had the good sense not to talk about God. Though he passed all the tests, Fat had faked them out. To while away the time, he drew over and over again pictures of the German knights who Alexander Nevsky had lured onto the ice, lured to their deaths. Fat identified with the heavily armored Teutonic knights with their slot-eyed masks and ox horns projecting out on each side. He drew each knight carrying a huge shield and a naked sword. On the shield, Fat wrote, "In hoc signo vinces," which he got from a pack of cigarettes. It means, "In this sign you shall conquer." The sign took the form of an iron cross. His love of God had turned into anger, an obscure anger. He had visions of Christopher racing across a grassy field, his little blue coat flapping behind him. Christopher running and running. No doubt this was horse lover Fat himself running, the child in him anyhow, running from something as obscure as his anger. In addition, he several times wrote, "Dico per spiritum sanctum, haec veritas est, mihi crede et mecum in aeternitate vivebis." Entry 28. This meant, "I speak by means of the Holy Spirit. This is the truth. Believe me, and you will live with me in eternity." One day, on a list of printed instructions posted on the wall of the corridor, he wrote, "Ex Deo nascimur, in Jesu mortimur, per spiritum sanctum revivissimus." Doug asked him what it meant. "From God we are born," Fat translated, "in Jesus we die, by the Holy Spirit we live again." "You're going to be here 90 days, Doug said. One time Fat found a posted notice that fascinated him. The notice stipulated what could not be done, in order of descending importance. Near the top of the list, all parties concerned were told, "No one is to remove ashtrays from the ward." And later down the list it stated, "Frontal lobotomies are not to be performed without the written consent of the patient." "That should read prefrontal," Doug said, and wrote in the pre. "How do you know that?" Fat said. "There's 2 ways of knowing," Doug said. Either knowledge arises through the sense organs and is called empirical knowledge, or it arises within your head, and it's called a priori. Doug wrote on the notice, "If I bring back the ashtrays, can I have my prefrontal?" "You'll be here 90 days, Fat said. Outside the building, rain poured down. It had been raining since Fat arrived in the North Ward. If he stood on top of the washing machine in the laundry room, he could see out through a barred window to the parking lot. People parked their cars and then ran through the rain. Fat felt glad he was indoors in the ward. Dr. Stone, who had charge of the ward, interviewed him one day. "Did you ever try suicide before?" Dr. Stone asked him. "No," Fat said, which of course wasn't true. At that moment, he no longer remembered Canada. It was his impression that his life had begun 2 weeks ago when Beth walked out. "I think," Dr. Stone said, "that when you tried to kill yourself, you got in touch with reality for the first time." "Maybe so," Fat said. "What I am going to give you," Dr. Stone said, opening a black suitcase on his small cluttered desk, "we term the batch remedies." He pronounced it batch. "These organic remedies are distilled from certain flowers which grow in Wales. Dr. Batch wandered through the fields and pastures of Wales, experiencing every negative mental state that exists. With each state that he experienced, he gently held one flower after another. The proper flower trembled in the cup of Dr. Batch's hand, and he then developed unique methods of acquiring an essence in elixir form of each flower and combinations of flowers, which I have prepared in a rum base." He put three bottles together on the desk, found a larger empty bottle, and poured the contents of the three into it. "Take 6 drops a day," Dr. Stone said. "There is no way the batch remedies can hurt you. They are not toxic chemicals. They will remove your sense of helplessness and fear and inability to act. My diagnosis is that those are the three areas you have blocks: fear, helplessness, and an inability to act. What you should have done instead of trying to kill yourself would have been take your son away from your wife. It's the law in California that a minor child must remain with his father until there is a court order to the contrary. And then you should have lightly struck your wife with a rolled-up newspaper or a phone book." "Thank you," Fat said, accepting the bottle. He could see that Dr. Stone was totally crazy, but in a good way. Dr. Stone was the first person at the North Ward, outside the patients, who had talked to him as if he were human. "You have much anger in you," Dr. Stone said. "I am lending you a copy of the Tao Te Ching. Have you ever read Lao Tzu?" "No," Fat admitted. "Let me read you this part here," Dr. Stone said. He read aloud. "Its upper part is not dazzling. Its lower part is not obscure. Dimly visible, it cannot be named, and returns to that which is without substance. This is called the shape that has no shape, the image that is without substance. This is called indistinct and shadowy. Go up to it, and you will not see its head. Follow behind it, and you will not see its rear." Hearing this, Fat remembered entries 1 and 2 from his journal. He quoted them, from memory, to Dr. Stone. 1. One mind there is, but under it 2 principles contend. 2. The mind lets in the light, then the dark, in interaction. So time is generated. At the end, mind awards victory to the light. Time ceases, and the mind is complete. But, Dr. Stone said, if mind awards victory to the light and the dark disappears, then reality will disappear, since reality is a compound of yang and yin equally. Yang is form 1 of Parmenides, Fat said. Yin is form 2. Parmenides argued that form 2 does not in fact exist. Only form 1 exists. Parmenides believed in a monistic world. People imagine that both forms exist, but they are wrong. Aristotle relates that Parmenides equates form 1 with that which is, and form 2 with that which is not. Thus, people are deluded. Eyeing him, Dr. Stone said, "What's your source?"
"Edward Hussey," Fat said.
"He's at Oxford," Dr. Stone said. "I attended Oxford. In my opinion, Hussey has no peer."
"You're right," Fat said.
"What else can you tell me?" Dr. Stone said.
Fat said, "Time does not exist. This is the great secret known to Apollonius of Tyana, Paul of Tarsus, Simon Magus, Paracelsus, Burma, and Bruno. The universe is contracting into a unitary entity which is completing itself. Decay and disorder are seen by us in reverse as increasing. Entry 18 of my exegesis reads, real time ceased in 70 CE with the fall of the Temple of Jerusalem. It began again in 1974. The intervening period was a perfect spurious interpolation, aping the creation of the mind."
"Interpolated by whom?" Dr. Stone asked.
"The black iron prison, which is an expression of the empire. What has been..."
Fat had started to say, "what has been revealed to me." He rechose his words.
"What has been most important in my discoveries is this. The empire never ended."
Leaning against his desk, Dr. Stone folded his arms, rocked forward and back, and studied Fat, waiting to hear more.
"That's all I know," Fat said, becoming belatedly cautious.
"I'm very interested in what you're saying," Dr. Stone said. Fat realized that one of two possibilities existed, and only two. Either Dr. Stone was totally insane, not just insane, but totally so, or else in an artful, professional fashion he had gotten Fat to talk. He had drawn Fat out, and now knew that Fat was totally insane, which meant that Fat could look forward to a court appearance in 90 days. This is a mournful discovery. 1. Those who agree with you are insane. 2. Those who do not agree with you are in power. Those were the twin realizations which now percolated through Fat's head. He decided to go for broke, to tell Dr. Stone the most fantastic entry in his exegesis.
"Entry number 24, Fat said. "In dormant seed form, as living information, the plasmate slumbered in the buried library of codices at Kinabaskion until..."
"What is Kinabaskion?" Dr. Stone interrupted.
"Nag Hammadi."
"Oh, the Gnostic library." Dr. Stone nodded. "Found and read in 1945, but never published.
Living information?"
His eyes fixed themselves in intense scrutiny of Fat.
"Living information," he echoed.
And then he said, "The Logos."
Fat trembled.
"Yes," Dr. Stone said. "The Logos would be living information, capable of replicating."
"Replicating not through information," Fat said, "in information, but as information. This is what Jesus meant when he spoke elliptically of the mustard seed, which he said would grow into a tree large enough for birds to roost in."
"There is no mustard tree," Dr. Stone agreed, "so Jesus could not have meant that literally. That fits with the so-called secrecy theme of Mark, that he didn't want outsiders to know the truth. And you know.
Jesus foresaw not only his own death, but that of all..."
Fat hesitated. "Homoplasmates.
That's a human being to which the plasmate has cross-bonded. Interspecies symbiosis. As living information, the plasmate travels up the optic nerve of a human to the pineal body. It uses the human brain as a female host."
Dr. Stone grunted and squeezed himself violently.
"In which to replicate itself into its active form," Fat said.
"The Hermetic alchemists knew of it in theory from ancient texts, but could not duplicate it, since they could not locate the dormant buried plasmate." "But you're saying the plasmate, the Logos, was dug up at Nag Hammadi?"
"Yes, when the codices were read."
"You're sure it wasn't in dormant seed form at Qumran, in Cave 5?
Well?
Fat said uncertainly. Where did the plasmate originally come from? After a pause, Fat said,
From another star system.
You wish to identify that star system?
Sirius,
Fat said. Then you believe that the Dogon people of the Western Sudan are the source of Christianity?
They use the fish sign, Fat said, for Nomo, the benign twin,
who would be Form One, or Yang.
Right, Fat said.
And Urugu is Form Two, but you believe that Form Two doesn't exist.
Nomo had to slay her, Fat said.
That's what the Japanese myth stipulates, in a sense, Dr. Stone said. Their cosmogonical myth. The female twin dies, giving birth to fire. Then she descends under the ground. The male twin goes after her to restore her, but finds her decomposing and giving birth to monsters. She pursues him, and he seals her up under the ground.
Amazed, Fat said, She's decomposing, and yet she's still giving birth?
Only to monsters, Dr. Stone said. About this time, two new propositions entered Fat's mind, due to this particular conversation. One, some of those in power are insane. Two, and they are right. By right, read in touch with reality. Fat had reverted back to his most dismal insight, that the universe and the mind behind it, which governed it, are both totally irrational. He wondered if he should mention this to Dr. Stone, who seemed to understand Fat better than anyone else during all Fat's life.
Dr. Stone, he said, there's something I want to ask you. I want your professional opinion.
Name it.
Could the universe possibly be irrational?
You mean not guided by a mind? I suggest you turn to Xenophanes.
Sure, Fat said.
Xenophanes of Colophon. One god there is, in no way like mortal creatures, either in bodily form or in the thought of his mind. The whole of him sees, the whole of him thinks, the whole of him hears. He stays always motionless in the same place. It is not right.
Fitting, Dr. Stone corrected.
It is not fitting that he should move about now this way, now that. And the important part, fragment 25, but effortlessly he wields all things by the thought of his mind.
But he could be irrational, Fat said.
How would we know?
The whole universe would be irrational.
Dr. Stone said, compared with what? That Fat hadn't thought of. But as soon as he thought of it, he realized that it did not tear down his fear, it increased it. If the whole universe were irrational, because it was directed by an irrational, that is to say, insane, mind, whole species could come into existence, live, and perish, and never guess, precisely for the reason that Stone had just given. The Logos isn't rational, Fat decided out loud. What I call the plasmate, buried as information in the codices at Nag Hammadi, which is back with us now, creating new homoplasmates. The Romans, the Empire, killed all the original ones. But you say real time ceased in 70 AD, when the Romans destroyed the temple. Therefore, these are still Roman times. The Romans are still here. This is roughly, Dr. Stone calculated, about 100 AD. Fat realized then that this explained his double exposure, the superimposition he had seen of ancient Rome and California 1974. Dr. Stone had solved it for him. The psychiatrist in charge of treating him for his lunacy had ratified it. Now Fat would never depart from faith in his encounter with God. Dr. Stone had nailed it down. 5. Fat spent 13 days at North Ward, drinking coffee and reading and walking around with Doug, but he never got to talk to Dr. Stone again because Stone had too many responsibilities, inasmuch as he had charge of the whole ward and everyone in it, staff and patients alike. Well, he did have one brief dipshit hurried interchange at the time of his discharge from the ward. "I think you're ready to leave," Stone said cheerfully. Fat said, "But let me ask you. I'm not talking about no mind at all directing the universe. I'm talking about a mind like Xenophanes conceived of, but the mind is insane." "The Gnostics believed that the creator deity was insane," Stone said. "Blind. I want to show you something. It hasn't been published yet. I have it in a typescript from Orville Wintermute, who is currently working with Befki in translating the Nag Hammadi codices. This quote comes from On the Origin of the World. Read it." Fat read it to himself, holding the precious typescript. He said, "I am God, and no other one exists except me." But when he said these things, he sinned against all of the immortal, imperishable ones, and they protected him. Moreover, when Pistis saw the impiety of the chief ruler, she was angry. Without being seen, she said, "You err, Samael," i.e., the blind god. "An enlightened, immortal man exists before you. This will appear within your molded bodies. He will trample upon you like potter's clay, which is trampled, and you will go with those who are yours down to your mother, the abyss." At once Fat understood what he had read. Samael was the creator deity, and he imagined that he was the only god, as stated in Genesis. However, he was blind, which is to say, occluded. Occluded was Fat's salient term. It embraced all other terms: insane, mad, irrational, whacked out, fucked up, fried, psychotic. In his blindness, state of irrationality, i.e., cut off from reality, he did not realize that. "What did the typescript say?" Feverishly, he searched over it, at which Dr. Stone thereupon patted him on the arm and told him he could keep the typescript. Stone had Xeroxed it several times over. An enlightened, immortal man existed before the creator deity, and that enlightened, immortal man would appear within the human race which Samael was going to create. And that enlightened, immortal man, who had existed before the creator deity, would trample upon the fucked-up, blind, deluded creator like potter's clay. Hence, Fat's encounter with God, the true God, had come through the little pot Oho, which Stephanie had thrown for him on her kick-wheel. "Then I'm right about Nag Hammadi," he said to Dr. Stone. "You would know," Dr. Stone said, and then he said something that no one had ever said to Fat before. "You're the authority," Dr. Stone said. Fat realized that Stone had restored his, Fat's, spiritual life. Stone had saved him. He was a master psychiatrist. Everything which Stone had said and done vis-a-vis Fat had a therapeutic basis, a therapeutic thrust. Whether the content of Stone's information was correct was not important. His purpose from the beginning had been to restore Fat's faith in himself, which had vanished when Beth left, which had vanished, actually, when he had failed to save Gloria's life years ago. Dr. Stone wasn't insane. Stone was a healer. He held down the right job. Probably he healed many people, and in many ways. He adapted his therapy to the individual, not the individual to the therapy. I'll be goddamned, Fat thought. In that simple sentence, "You're the authority," Stone had given Fat back his soul. The soul which Gloria, with her hideous, malignant, psychological death game, had taken away. They, note the they, paid Dr. Stone to figure out what had destroyed the patient entering the ward. In each case, a bullet had been fired at him, somewhere, at some time in his life. The bullet entered him, and the pain began to spread out. Insidiously, the pain filled him up until he split in half, right down the middle. The task of the staff, and even of the other patients, was to put the person back together, but this could not be done so long as the bullet remained. All that lesser therapists did was note the person split into two pieces and begin the job of patching him back into a unity. But they failed to find and remove the bullet. The fatal bullet fired at the person was the basis of Freud's original attack on the psychologically injured person. Freud had understood. He called it a trauma. Later on, everyone got tired of searching for the fatal bullet. It took too long. Too much had to be learned about the patient. Dr. Stone had a paranormal talent, like his paranormal batch remedies, which were a palpable hoax, a pretext to listen to the patient. Rum with a flower dipped in it. Nothing more but a sharp mind hearing what the patient said. Dr. Leon Stone turned out to be one of the most important people in horse lover Fat's life. To get to Stone, Fat had had to nearly kill himself physically, matching his mental death. Is this what they mean about God's mysterious ways? How else could Fat have linked up with Leon Stone? Only some dismal act of the order of a suicide attempt, a truly lethal attempt, would have achieved it. Fat had to die, or nearly die, to be cured, or nearly cured. I wonder where Leon Stone practices now. I wonder what his recovery rate is. I wonder how he got his paranormal abilities. I wonder a lot of things. The worst event in Fat's life, Beth leaving him, taking Christopher, and Fat trying to kill himself, had brought on limitless benign consequences. If you judge the merits of a sequence by their final outcome, Fat had just gone through the best period of his life. He emerged from North Ward as strong as he would ever get. After all, no man is infinitely strong. For every creature that runs, flies, hops, or crawls, there is a terminal nemesis which he will not circumvent, which will finally do him in. But Dr. Stone had added the missing element to Fat, the element taken away from him, half deliberately, by Gloria Knudsen, who wished to take as many people with her as she could. Self-confidence. "You are the authority," Stone had said, and that sufficed. I've always told people that for each person there is a sentence, a series of words, which has the power to destroy him. When Fat told me about Leon Stone, I realized, this came years after the first realization, that another sentence exists, another series of words, which will heal the person. If you're lucky, you will get the second, but you can be certain of getting the first. That is the way it works. On their own, without training, individuals know how to deal out the lethal sentence, but training is required to deal out the second. Stephanie had come close when she made the little ceramic pot Oh-Ho and presented it to Fat as her gift of love, a love she lacked the verbal skills to articulate. How, when Stone gave Fat the typescript material from the Nag Hammadi Codex, had he known the significance of pot and potter to Fat? To know that, Stone would have to be telepathic. Well, I have no theory. Fat, of course, has. He believes that, like Stephanie, Dr. Stone was a microform of God. That's why I say Fat is nearly healed, not healed. Yet by regarding benign people as microforms of God, Fat at least remained in touch with a good God, not a blind, cruel, or evil one. That point should be considered. Fat had a high regard for God. If the Logos was rational, and the Logos equaled God, then God had to be rational. This is why the fourth gospel's statement about the identity of the Logos is so important. Kai theos ein halagos, which is to say, and the Word was God. In the New Testament, Jesus says that no one has seen God but him, that is, Jesus Christ, the Logos of the fourth gospel. If that be correct, what Fat experienced was the Logos. But the Logos is God, so to experience Christ is to experience God. Perhaps a more important statement shows up in a book of the New Testament which most people don't read. They read the Gospels and the letters of Paul, but who reads 1 John? My dear people, we are already the children of God, but what we are to be in the future has not yet been revealed. All we know is that we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he really is. 1 John 3, 1-2. It can be argued that this is the most important statement in the New Testament. Certainly it is the most important, not generally known statement. We shall be like him. That means that man is isomorphic with God. We shall see him as he really is. There will occur a theophany, at least to some. Fat could base the credentials for his whole encounter on this passage. He could claim that his encounter with God consisted of a fulfillment of the promise of 1 John 3:1-2, as Bible scholars indicated, a sort of code which they can read off in an instant, as cryptic as it looks. Oddly, to a certain extent, this passage dovetails with the Nag Hammadi typescript that Dr. Stone handed to Fat the day Fat got discharged from North Ward. Man and the true God are identical, as the Logos and the true God are, but a lunatic blind creator and his screwed-up world separate man from God. That the blind creator sincerely imagines that he is the true God only reveals the extent of his occlusion. This is Gnosticism. In Gnosticism, man belongs with God against the world and the creator of the world, both of which are crazy, whether they realize it or not. The answer to Fat's question, is the universe irrational, and is it irrational because an irrational mind governs it, receives this answer via Dr. Stone. Yes, it is. The universe is irrational. The mind governing it is irrational. But above them lies another God, the true God, and he is not irrational. In addition, that true God has outwitted the powers of this world, ventured here to help us, and we know him as the Logos, which, according to Fat, is living information. Perhaps Fat has discerned a vast mystery in calling the Logos living information, but perhaps not. Proving things of this sort is difficult. Who do you ask? Fat, fortunately, asked Leon Stone. He might have asked one of the staff, in which case he would still be in North Ward, drinking coffee, reading, walking around with Doug. Above everything else, outranking every other aspect, object, quality of his encounter, Fat had witnessed a benign power, which had invaded this world. No other term fitted it. The benign power, whatever it was, had invaded this world, like a champion ready to do battle. That terrified him, but it also excited his joy, because he understood what it meant. Help had come. The universe might be irrational, but something rational had broken into it, like a thief in the night breaks into a sleeping household, unexpectedly in terms of place, in terms of time. Fat had seen it, not because there was anything special about him, but because it had wanted him to see it. Normally, it remained camouflaged. Normally, when it appeared, no one could distinguish it from ground. Set to ground, as Fat correctly expressed it. He had a name for it. Zebra. Because it blended. The name for this is mimesis. Another name is mimicry. Certain insects do this. They mimic other things. Sometimes, other insects, poisonous ones, or twigs and the like. Certain biologists and naturalists have speculated that higher forms of mimicry might exist, since lower forms, which is to say, forms which fool those intended to be fooled, but not us, have been found all over the world. What if a high form of sentient mimicry existed? Such a high form that no human, or few humans, had detected it. What if it could only be detected if it wanted to be detected? Which is to say, not truly detected at all, since under these circumstances it had advanced out of its camouflaged state to disclose itself. Disclose might in this case equal theophany. The astonished human being would say, I saw God, whereas in fact he saw only a highly evolved ultra-terrestrial life form, a UTI, or an extraterrestrial life form, an ETI, which had come here at some time in the past. And perhaps, as Fat conjectured, had slumbered for nearly 2,000 years in dormant seed form as living information in the codices at Nag Hammadi, which explained why reports of its existence had broken off abruptly around 70 AD. Entry 33 in Fat's journal, i.e. his exegesis. This loneliness, this anguish of the bereaved mind, is felt by every constituent of the universe. All its constituents are alive. Thus, the ancient Greek thinkers were hylozoists. A hylozoist believes that the universe is alive. It's about the same idea as panpsychism, that everything is animated. Panpsychism, or hylozoism, falls into two belief classes. One, each object is independently alive. Two, everything is one unitary entity. The universe is one thing, alive, with one mind. Fat had found a kind of middle ground. The universe consists of one vast irrational entity into which has broken a high-order life form which camouflages itself by a sophisticated mimicry. Thereby, as long as it cares to, it remains, by us, undetected. It mimics objects and causal processes. This is what Fat claims. Not just objects, but what the objects do. From this, you can gather that Fat conceives of zebra as very large. After a year of analyzing his encounter with zebra, or God, or the Logos, whatever, Fat came first to the conclusion that it had invaded our universe, and a year later he realized that it was consuming, that is, devouring, our universe. Zebra accomplished this by a process much like transubstantiation. This is the miracle of communion in which the two species, the wine and bread, invisibly become the blood and body of Christ. Instead of seeing this in church, Fat had seen it out in the world, and not in micro form, but in macro form, which is to say, on a scale so vast that he could not estimate its limits. The entire universe, possibly, is in the invisible process of turning into the Lord. And with this process comes not just sentience, but sanity. For Fat, this would be a blessed relief. He had put up with insanity for too long, both in himself and outside himself. Nothing could have pleased him more. If Fat was psychotic, you must admit that it is a strange sort of psychosis to believe that you have encountered an inbreaking of the rational into the irrational. How do you treat it? Send the afflicted person back to square one? In that case, he is now cut off from the rational. This makes no sense in terms of therapy. It is an oxymoron, a verbal contradiction. But an even more basic semantic problem lies exposed here. Suppose I say to Fat, or Kevin says to Fat, you did not experience God. You merely experienced something with the qualities and aspects and nature and powers and wisdom and goodness of God. This is like the joke about the German proclivity toward double abstractions. A German authority on English literature declares, Hamlet was not written by Shakespeare, it was merely written by a man named Shakespeare. In English, the distinction is verbal and without meaning, although German as a language will express the difference, which accounts for some of the strange features of the German mind. I saw God, Fat states, and Kevin and I and Sherry state, no, you just saw something like God, exactly like God. And having spoke, we do not stay to hear the answer, like jesting Pilate upon his asking, what is truth? Zebra broke through into our universe and fired beam after beam of information-rich colored light at Fat's brain, right through his skull, blinding him and fucking him up and dazing and dazzling him, but imparting to him knowledge beyond the telling. For openers, it saved Christopher's life. More accurately speaking, it didn't break through to fire the information. It had at some past date broken through. What it did was step forward out of its state of camouflage. It disclosed itself as set to ground and fired information at a rate our calculations will not calibrate. It fired whole libraries at him in nanoseconds, and it continued to do this for 8 hours of real elapsed time. Many nanoseconds exist in 8 hours of RET. At flash cut speed, you can load the right hemisphere of the human brain with a titanic quantity of graphic data. Paul of Tarsus had a similar experience, a long time ago. Much of it he refused to discuss. According to his own statement, much of the information fired at his head, right between the eyes on his trip to Damascus, died with him unsaid. Chaos reigns in the universe, but St. Paul knew who he had talked to. He mentioned that. Zebra, too, identified itself to Fat. It termed itself St. Sophia, a designation unfamiliar to Fat. St. Sophia is an unusual hypostasis of Christ. Men and the world are mutually toxic to each other, but God, the true God, has penetrated both, penetrated man and penetrated the world, and sobers the landscape. But that God, the God from outside, encounters fierce opposition. Frauds, the deceptions of madness, abound and mask themselves as their mirror opposite, pose as sanity. The masks, however, wear thin, and the madness reveals itself. It is an ugly thing. The remedy is here, but so is the malady. As Fat repeats obsessively, the empire never ended. In a startling response to the crisis, the true God mimics the universe, the very region he has invaded. He takes on the likeness of sticks and trees and beer cans in gutters. He presumes to be trash discarded, debris no longer noticed. Lurking, the true God literally ambushes reality, and us as well. God, in very truth, attacks and injures us in his role as antidote. As Fat can testify to, it is a scary experience to be bushwhacked by the living God. Hence we say the true God is in the habit of concealing himself. 2,500 years have passed since Heraclitus wrote, "Latent form is the master of obvious form," and "the nature of things is in the habit of concealing itself." So the rational, like a seed, lies concealed within the irrational bulk. What purpose does the irrational bulk serve? Ask yourself what Gloria gained by dying, not in terms of her death vis-à-vis herself, but in terms of those who loved her. She paid back their love with, well, with what? Malice? Not proven. Hate? Not proven. With the irrational? Yes, proven. In terms of the effect on her friends, such as Fat, no lucid purpose was served, but purpose there was. Purpose without purpose, if you can conceive of that. Her motive was no motive. We're talking about nihilism. Under everything else, even under death itself and the will towards death, lies something else, and that something else is nothing. The bedrock basic stratum of reality is irreality. The universe is irrational because it is built not on mere shifting sand, but on that which is not. No help to Fat to know this. The why of Gloria's taking him with her, or doing her best to, when she went. "Bitch," he could have said if he could have grabbed her. "Just tell me why. Why the fucking why?" To which the universe would hollowly respond, "My ways cannot be known, O man." Which is to say, my ways do not make sense, nor do the ways of those who dwell in me. The bad news coming down the pipe for Fat was mercifully still unknown to him at this point, at the time of his discharge from North Ward. He could not return to Beth, so who could he return to when he hit the outside world? In his mind, during his stay at North Ward, Sherry, who was in remission from her cancer, had faithfully visited him. Therefore, Fat had engrammed onto her, believing that if he had one true friend in all the world, it was Sherry Solvig. His plan had unfolded like a bright star. He would live with Sherry, helping to keep up her morale during her remission, and if she lost her remission, he would care for her, as she had cared for him during his time in the hospital. In no sense had Dr. Stone cured Fat when the motor-driving Fat got later exposed. Fat homed in on death more rapidly and more expertly this time than he had ever done before. He had become a professional at seeking out pain. He had learned the rules of the game and now knew how to play. What Fat, in his lunacy, acquired from a lunatic universe, branded so by Fat's own analysis, thought was to be dragged down along with someone who wanted to die. Had he gone through his address book, he could not have yielded up a better source than Sherry. Smart move, Fat, I would have told him, if I had known what he was planning for his future during his stay at North Ward. You've really scored this time. I knew Sherry. I knew she spent all her time trying to figure out a way to lose her remission. I knew that because she expressed fury and hatred constantly at the doctors who had saved her. But I did not know what Fat had planned. Fat kept it a secret, even from Sherry. I will help her, Fat said to himself in the depths of his fried mind. I will help Sherry stay healthy, but if and when she gets sick again, there I will be at her side, ready to do anything for her. His error, when deconstructed, amounted to this. Sherry did not merely plan to get sick again. She, like Gloria, planned to take as many people with her as possible, in direct proportion to their love toward her. Fat loved her, and worse, felt gratitude towards her. Out of this clay, Sherry could throw a pot with the warped kick wheel she used as a brain that would smash what Leon Stone had done, smash what Stephanie had done, smash what God had done. Sherry had more power in her weakened body than all these other entities combined, including the living God. Fat had decided to bind himself to the Antichrist, and out of the highest possible motive, out of love, gratitude, and the desire to help her. Exactly what the powers of hell feed on, the best instincts in man. Sherry Solvig, being poor, lived in a tiny run-down room with no kitchen. She had to wash her dishes in the bathroom sink. The ceiling showed a vast water stain from a toilet upstairs which had overflowed. Having visited her there a couple of times, Fat knew the place and considered it depressing. He had the impression that if Sherry moved out and into a nice apartment, a modern one, and with a kitchen, her spirits would pick up. Needless to say, the realization had never penetrated to Fat's mind that Sherry sought out this kind of abode. Her dingy surroundings came as a result of her affliction, not as a cause. She could recreate these conditions wherever she went, which Fat eventually discovered. At this point in time, however, Fat had geared up his mental and physical assembly line to turn out an endless series of good acts toward the person who, before all other persons, had visited him in the cardiac intensive care ward and later at North Ward. Sherry had official documents declaring her a Christian. Twice a week she took communion, and one day she would enter a religious order. Also, she called her priest by his first name. You cannot get any closer to piety than that. A couple of times Fat had told Sherry about his encounter with God. This hadn't impressed her, since Sherry Solvig believed that one encounters God only through channels. She herself has access to these channels, which is to say, her priest, Larry. Once Fat had read to Sherry from the Britannica about the secrecy theme in Mark and Matthew, the idea that Christ veiled his teachings in parable form so that the multitude, that is, the many outsiders, would not understand him, and so would not be saved. Christ, according to this view or theme, intended salvation only for his little flock. The Britannica discussed this up front. That's bullshit, Sherry said. Fat said, You mean this Britannica is wrong or the Bible is wrong? The Britannica is just... The Bible doesn't say that, Sherry said, who read the Bible all the time, or at least had a copy of it always with her. It took Fat hours to find the citation in Luke. Finally, he had it, to set before Sherry. His disciples asked him what this parable might mean, and he said, The mysteries of the kingdom of God are revealed to you. For the rest, there are only parables, so that they might see but not perceive, listen but not understand. Luke 8:9-10. I'll ask Larry if that's one of the corrupt parts of the Bible, Sherry said. Pissed off, Fat said irritably, Sherry, why don't you cut out all the sections of the Bible you agree with and paste them together, and not have to deal with the rest? Don't be snippy, Sherry said, who was hanging up clothes in her tiny closet. Nonetheless, Fat imagined that basically he and Sherry shared a common bond. They both agreed that God existed. Christ had died to save man. People who didn't believe this didn't know what was going on. He had confided to her that he had seen God, news which Sherry received placidly. At that moment, she had been ironing. "It's called a theophany," Fat said, "or an epiphany." "An epiphany," Sherry said, pacing her voice to the rate of her slow ironing, "is a feast celebrated on January 6th, marking the baptism of Christ. I always go. Why don't you go? It's a lovely service. You know, I heard this joke..." She droned on. Hearing this, Fat was mystified. He decided to change the subject. Now, Sherry had switched to an account of an instance when Larry, who was Father Minter to Fat, had poured the sacramental wine down the front of a kneeling female communicant's low-cut dress. "Do you think John the Baptist was an Essene?" he asked Sherry. Never at any time did Sherry Solvig admit she didn't know the answer to a theological question. The closest she came surfaced in the form of responding, "I'll ask Larry." To Fat, she now said calmly, "John the Baptist was Elijah, who returns before Christ comes. They asked Christ about that, and he said John the Baptist was Elijah, who had been promised." "But was he an Essene?" Pausing momentarily in her ironing, Sherry said, "Didn't the Essenes live in the Dead Sea?" "Well, at the Qumran Wadi." "Didn't your friend Bishop Pike die in the Dead Sea?" Fat had known Jim Pike, a fact he always proudly narrated to people given a pretext. "Yes," he said. "Jim and his wife had driven out onto the Dead Sea desert in a Ford Cortina. They had two bottles of Coca-Cola with them, that's all." "You told me," Sherry said, resuming her ironing. "What I could never figure out," Fat said, "is why they didn't drink the water in the car radiator. That's what you do when your car breaks down in the desert and you're stranded." For years, Fat had brooded about Jim Pike's death. He imagined that it was somehow tied in with the murders of the Kennedys and Dr. King, but he had no evidence whatsoever for it. "Maybe they had antifreeze in their radiator," Sherry said. "In the Dead Sea Desert?" Sherry said, "My car has been giving me trouble. The man at the Exxon station on 17th says that the motor mounts are loose. Is that serious?" Not wanting to talk about Sherry's beat-up old car, but wanting instead to rattle on about Jim Pike, Fat said, "I don't know." He tried to think how to get the topic back to his friend's perplexing death, but could not. "That damn car," Sherry said. "You didn't pay anything for it. That guy gave it to you." "Didn't pay anything? He made me feel like he owned me for giving me that damn car." "Remind me never to give you a car," Fat said. All the clues lay before him that day. If you did something for Sherry, she felt she should feel gratitude, which she did not, and this she interpreted as a burden, a despised obligation. However, Fat had a ready rationalization for this, which he had already begun to employ. He did not do things for Sherry to get anything back. Ergo, he did not expect gratitude. Ergo, if he did not get it, that was okay. What he failed to notice was that not only was there no gratitude, which he could psychologically handle, but downright malice showed itself instead. Fat had noted this, but had written it off as nothing more than irritability, a form of impatience. He could not believe that someone would return malice for assistance. Therefore, he discounted the testimony of his senses. Once, when I lectured at the University of California at Fullerton, a student asked me for a short, simple definition of reality. I thought it over and answered, "Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, it doesn't go away." Fant did not believe that Sherry returned malice for assistance given her, but that failure to believe changed nothing. Therefore, her response lay within the framework of what we call reality. Fat, whether he liked it or not, would in some way have to deal with it, or else stop seeing Sherry socially. One of the reasons Beth left Fat stemmed from his visits to Sherry at her run-down room in Santa Ana. Fat had deluded himself into believing that he visited her out of charity. Actually, he had become horny, due to the fact that Beth had lost interest in him sexually, and he was not, as they say, getting any. In many ways, Sherry struck him as pretty. In fact, Sherry was pretty. We all agreed. During her chemotherapy, she wore a wig. David had been fooled by the wig and often complimented her on her hair, which amused her. We regarded this as macabre on both their parts. In his study on the form that masochism takes in modern man, Theodor Reich puts forth an interesting view. Masochism is more widespread than we realize because it takes an attenuated form. The basic dynamism is as follows. A human being sees something bad which is coming as inevitable. There is no way he can halt the process. He is helpless. This sense of helplessness generates a need to gain some control over the impending pain. Any kind of control will do. This makes sense. The subjective feeling of helplessness is more painful than the impending misery. So the person seizes control over the situation in the only way open to him. He connives to bring on the impending misery. He hastens it. This activity on his part promotes the false impression that he enjoys pain. Not so. It is simply that he cannot any longer endure the helplessness, or the supposed helplessness. But in the process of gaining control over the inevitable misery, he becomes, automatically, anhedonic, which means being able or unwilling to enjoy pleasure. Anhedonia sets in stealthily. Over the years, it takes control of him. For example, he learns to defer gratification. This is a step in the dismal process of anhedonia. In learning to defer gratification, he experiences a sense of self-mastery. He has become stoic, disciplined. He does not give way to impulse. He has control. Control over himself in terms of his impulses, and control over the external situation. He is a controlled and controlling person. Pretty soon he has branched out and is controlling other people as part of the situation. He becomes a manipulator. Of course, he is not consciously aware of this. All he intends to do is lessen his own sense of impotence. But in his task of lessening this sense, he insidiously overpowers the freedom of others. Yet he derives no pleasure from this, no positive psychological gain. All his gains are essentially negative. Sherry Solvig had had cancer, lymphatic cancer, but due to valiant efforts by her doctors, she had gone into remission. However, encoded in the memory tapes of her brain was the datum that patients with lymphoma who go into remission usually eventually lose their remission. They aren't cured. The ailment has somehow mysteriously passed from a palpable state into a sort of metaphysical state, a limbo. It is there, but it is not there. So despite her current good health, Sherry, her mind told her, contained a ticking clock, and when the clock chimed, she would die. Nothing could be done about it, except the frantic promotion of a second remission. But even if a second remission were obtained, that remission too, by the same logic, the same inexorable process, would end. Time had Sherry in its absolute power. Time contained one outcome for her, terminal cancer. This is how her mind had factored the situation out. It had come to this conclusion, and no matter how good she felt, or what she had going for her in her life, this fact remained a constant. A cancer patient in remission, then, represents a stepped-up case of the status of all humans. Eventually, you are going to die. In the back of her mind, Sherry thought about death ceaselessly. Everything else, all people, objects, and processes had become reduced to the status of shadows. Worse yet, when she contemplated other people, she contemplated the injustice of the universe. They did not have cancer. This meant that, psychologically speaking, they were immortal. This was unfair. Everyone had conspired to rob her of her youth, her happiness, and eventually her life. In place of those, everyone else had piled infinite pain on her, and probably they secretly enjoyed it. Enjoying themselves and enjoying it amounted to the same evil thing. Sherry, therefore, had motivation for wishing that the whole world would go to hell in a handbasket. Of course, she did not say this aloud, but she lived it. Due to her cancer, she had become totally anhedonic. How can one deny the sense in this? Logically, Sherry should have squeezed every moment of pleasure out of life during her remission, but the mind does not function logically, as Fat had figured out. Sherry spent her time anticipating the loss of her remission. In this respect, she did not postpone gratification. She enjoyed her returning lymphoma now. Fat couldn't make this complex mental process out. He only saw a young woman who had suffered a lot and who had been dealt a bum hand. He reasoned that he could improve her life. That was a good thing to do. He would love her, love himself, and God would love the both of them. Fat saw love, and Sherry saw impending pain and death over which she had no control. There can be no meeting of such two different worlds. In summary, as Fat would say, the modern-day masochist does not enjoy pain. He simply can't stand being helpless. Enjoying pain is a semantic contradiction, as certain philosophers and psychologists have pointed out. Pain is defined as something that you experience as unpleasant. Unpleasant is defined as something you don't want. Try to define it otherwise and see where it gets you. Enjoying pain means enjoying what you find unpleasant. Reich had the handle on the situation. He decoded the true dynamism of modern attenuated masochism, and so it spread out among almost all of us, in one form or another, and to some degree. It has become an ubiquity. One could not correctly accuse Sherry of enjoying cancer, or even wanting to have cancer. But she believed that cancer lay in the deck of cards in front of her, buried somewhere in the pack. She turned one card over each day, and each day cancer failed to show up. But if that card is in the pack and you are turning the cards over one by one, eventually you will turn the cancer card over, and there it ends. So, through no real fault of her own, Sherry was primed to fuck Fat over, as he had never been fucked over before. The difference between Gloria Knudsen and Sherry was obvious. Gloria wanted to die for strictly imaginary reasons. Sherry would literally die, whether she wanted to or not. End of Side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.